in all of time, in all of history, man has never created one single living cell. Yet your body does that millions to billions of times a day. That's where I put my faith. So I try to encourage people. I want them to know that, listen, that there's a doctor 24/7 on the clock, making chemicals, making hormones, detoxing you. So yeah, compared to the smartest person you know or the greatest doctor you think, I'm just saying that level of intelligence is laughable compared to the wisdom that is in you right now, animating you so you can even hear me say this. If I can help you understand the magnificence of the body that God gave you, your fear of disease drops significantly. Your fear of a fever drops significantly because you realize that you're designed to heal. So I'm Dr. Ben Rall. Welcome to Designed to Heal.
Welcome back to Designed to Heal. My name is Jeff, your co-host here with Dr. Ben Rall. And Ben, we got a guest on the line and you're super excited about, investigative journalist. This is always fun.
Yeah.
Well, and so what do we have?
Well, who would have thought that we would need, you know, here we are, a health and wellness show. If you would have ever thought, you know, years ago that you'd have to have an award-winning investigative journalist on here to discuss that topic, you would have said, well, what's the relationship to that? Why would you need that?
Yeah.
Right? Can't we... Because it begs some questions, right? Is there a reason we can't trust the science, if you will? Is there a reason that we should have current concerns for that? And anybody that's walked through these last, and here would be my assertion, though, a lot of people woke up over the last few years regarding COVID and saw how the sausage was made, and people are waking up to that. But my contention would be that there's been problems with this for a long, long time. Hmm. And our guest today, Paul Thacker, he runs has a great Substack newsletter, the Disinformation Chronicle, that you can follow. I mean, I'm just reading some of his, it's all the stuff that if you listen to this show that you would love. So welcome to the show, Paul.
Hey guys, thanks for having me on.
So will you tell us, give us a little bit of your backstory, because it does matter, it is important, how long you've been doing investigative journalism, why you do investigative journalism, and how you ended up doing a lot in the corruption kind of medical science research world.
So I started off, you know, I studied biology in college, and then I wanted to go to grad school, but I was working in a lab at Emory University doing, you know, bench research, and I sort of realized that, like, I really didn't want to take the test to get into grad school because I wasn't interested in spending more time in the classroom. And what I realized, what I really liked, was not so much doing science, but writing about science and learning about science. And so I got into journalism. I moved to New York. I did a couple of internships, one at Audubon Magazine, one at Discover Magazine, and I became a freelance journalist and did that for several years. Then I moved to Washington, D.C., and I was an editor for the news section of a journal called Environmental Science and Technology. It's the top journal in environmental science. And what I like to say, and it covers everything in environmental science, but water pollution, air pollution, you know, how to stop, you know, corrosion through pipes that like are carrying water, all that kind of stuff. And I used to say that, like, everyone submitting a study to environmental science and technology thinks they have a nature or a science paper, but they really just have an ES&T paper. So it was like, it's like the highest level. The next jump up is like the two big journals. And I sort of realized that I was writing stories about pollution and plastic dangers and stuff like that. And I realized that every time I write a story about this new research that came out, there was a ton of research behind it saying the same thing. And I was like, why is nothing happening to, like, you know, take these products off the market or to cause some regulations? And over time, I began reporting on this industry that created science, that basically on behalf of corporations would create science. And so they would create research to show that, like, something wasn't dangerous, that air pollution wasn't really all that bad, that, you know, this product that's in children's toys really doesn't harm kids. And I eventually wrote a story that got me pushed out. It was about a document I found about a group called the Weinberg Group. And this group has been written about quite a bit. It's been in a lot of news stories. I think there's just a documentary out on PBS that probably talks about it a little bit. But they were a science for hire group, and they had sent a letter to DuPont explaining how they were going to help protect DuPont against lawsuits and regulations involving a chemical called PFOA. Now, this is a chemical that was used to make a lot of nonstick products. And it was a teratogen, which means it harms kids during development. It was also very dangerous. And that article got me basically shoved out the door. And I eventually landed in the Senate Finance Committee because I'd running investigations into corruption in medicine. Finance oversees Medicare and Medicaid. And so we were looking at corruption in the pharmaceutical industry to try to control costs, because we were finding out that we were paying for these drugs that either weren't working, that are actually were dangerous. It was kind of crazy. The one investigation I ran that got national attention was a drug called Avandia. It was the best-selling drug on the market at the time to treat diabetes. And what we found out, it was causing cardiovascular events. Well, the reason why you take a diabetes drug is to stop cardiovascular events. That's one of the reasons why you take it. It was actually causing cardiovascular events. And I also put together, to try to deal with the systemic corruption in medicine, I drafted and helped to pass a law called the Physician Payment Sunshine Act. And so now in the States and a couple other countries, you can now look up your doctor and see what companies are paying your doctor and why, and what it's paying it for. Because we kept finding out that, every time there'd be a drug that would come on the market that was dangerous, you'd find out it got there because the pharmaceutical industry was paying all these doctors to promote it, to write studies about it. They would be on the panels to get it approved for treatments. And so we were trying to fix some of that stuff. And then
Paul, can I ask you something before, just right there? So was it a slow, I don't know what the right word is, a slow fade or a slow awakening? I hate some of these words because I don't know what we can use right now because they have different connotations. But when you first started, were you a believer that back in Emory days and, even your bio, hey, science is something that can't be bought and there's just this truth and it gets put in journals. And then you started kind of learning more about the corruption. And then, over your years and years and years of work, now it's like, man, it's worse. Because here is, I'm a chiropractic physician, so I'm a doctor. So I do my thing. Jeff, he always bills my co-host here. He always calls himself the average Jeff. And we kind of go at this because I think, you do this for a living, or sometimes I say to people, I do health all day. I study health. I get to work with people. So it's my job. And thankfully I like it. But the average person that tries to decipher today's headlines or trust somebody, I'm at the point, and I feel like a lot of my patients and probably listeners here are at the point, I don't trust a damn thing that comes out of their mouth. And you being on the inside, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but was it a slow wake up for you? And was there something where just the dam broke, when that article happened? I was thinking about that movie, I think it was Dark Waters. Didn't they make that film about the DuPont bit? Yeah.
So that actually, the document that I wrote about that got me pushed out the door from the American Council, American Chemical Society, the journal Environmental Science and Technology, that was about a document that lawyer, Rob Bellott, who's the focus of that movie, he had leaked, and I got a hold of that document.
Wow.
And I wrote about that. So I was the first one to write about that case and what was going on. And then he eventually appeared in the New York Times, and I sent him an email Rob, here it is. I wrote this article in 2007, and now it's 2014, and you're in the New York Times. And he's like, yeah, it's been a long time.
It a wake up for you or what happened?
I mean, for me, it was just I was definitely one of these, right? I mean, why do you go study science? Because you think science is awesome. And I was science is awesome. It fixed all the problems. Mm. And then eventually you just realize over time that there's a ton of corruption in science because there's a lot of money at stake, And I mean, what the whole Dark Waters thing about that movie, to use that as an example, and what DuPont was doing is, what was at risk was not just these products that they were, putting on the market. There's a requirement to change how they make them, which is expensive, but also they polluted the environment. And so there was going to be all this cleanup cost. So it was in their financial interest to create research to show that their product was not dangerous, which is what they did. And it took this lawyer, Rob Bellott, fighting for years to do this. Now, when I wrote that article at the time, I remember I was kind of already known in the office as the guy who would look out for the dirt, And I was just I was just interested in it. I was just what is going on here? Why are we not? We have this research showing this and we're doing something totally different. Why is that happening? And why don't we talk about it? And then when you move into medicine, I say is where it's more complicated. And the best I can tell you is that like my entire position on a lot of science, and particularly medicine, is way more cynical today than it was in the past. Mm. I have serious concerns. I mean, the latest thing that's out right now is this this drug called Ozempic or right. Wegovy or whatever it is, right, to treat obesity. And I'm just kind of like, I don't know exactly what's going on with that drug, but like when I heard that like it was actually like a lot of the weight loss was muscle, like yeah. and not fat, I was like not surprised. Like this thing was being, you know, shoved around like it was going to solve all the problems of obesity and public health. And I'm just like, that's just not how it works. Like I've seen this story so many times, you know. I mean, and you know, I mean, we at the same time we were going through the COVID, you know, crisis, right? Yeah. Pandemic. I mean, what was going on? I just heard today on BBC about we've forgotten about the fact that there was an opioid epidemic, and we know that was started by the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah,
and so. You know, and so just I think I've become across, I'm much more skeptical about what I find in science because I know that science is a process. Science and medicine are processes that are developed and led by humans, and humans have problems. We're greedy, we're narcissists, we're scared to speak up when something's wrong. We think we're smarter than we actually are. Like all these problems that are endemic in the human system like are endemic in science and medicine.
So what do you think? I mean, maybe we'll start here and just as a thought. So like you said, and I'm the same way, you're not going to offend me. I mean, I'm so skeptical about today's science that comes out of industry. I think not to be is really a bad idea. Now, of course it's heartbreaking, right? And it does lead to just some frustration because these things, you know, who do I trust kind of come out. But I always encourage people, my patients, listeners, to say, listen, you know, use that brain that God gave you, like logic and some discernment and just some thoughts. Like you said about that, like, yeah, you have experience with Avandia and those other drugs, like, you know, another diabetes drug, which is what they're trying to, you know, market Ozempic. You know, it's a diabetes drug. It's like any drug, or the same thing happened with the jabs where they said this thing is 100% safe and effective. Of course, that was how it initially came out. And then just down the road, the truth, if you will, starts to come out. But I don't think people need to always wait for the, you know, the 3, 4, 5 years down the road. Any synthetic right. man-made chemical is going to have problems with it. And I think we are wise to try to, we don't doctor over the airwaves here, but I think it's wise to try to say, hey, is there anything else I can do? And just, you know, use logic. But then, you know, do you have thoughts, Paul, on just like the propaganda of this? So what a lot of things get billed off as science are really, in my opinion, just kind of propaganda headlines, sound bites made by marketing. You had an article that you recently wrote about a science magazine reaches a new low, defames the critics. You were talking about this happened to be referencing the Wuhan lab leak and how at the time that was viewed as, you know, heresy and misinformation and conspiracy theory. Now it's, I would say, the leading thought of what happened. So what's
right.
Do you have some thoughts on how the average person can navigate, or how you would suggest they look at quote science or even the stuff that they often really see through popular press or media other than turn it off?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, this is what I do for a living and I have a problem. Like, you know, I mean, I do this for a living. And I feel like, I mean, I can tell you right now, there are some reporters and some just say media outlets or some organizations that I follow, not because I think they're giving out good information, but because I know they're giving out information that from a specific point of view. Mm. And I want to know what that industry or what that special interest is trying to get out. You know, like, yeah. I'm like, okay, what's this message you're trying to do? You know? And so, I mean, there's a reporter at a big media outlet called Stat News, which is like, a fairly well-known online outlet on medicine and pharmaceuticals, physician stuff. And there's a reporter there who I know is just so close to all of the, you know, the heads of the corporations, of the pharma companies. And I read him almost like, because I want to know, like, okay, what do these CEOs want us to think?
Yeah. Who did you he know? Have dinner with so, last night? Yeah. Who did he?
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, I mean, I know why they're going to, I mean, I can tell you, like, a lot of times, like, when I send questions to people, like, they don't respond. You know, they're like, oh, it's this guy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, this is going to be fun, you know? And when they have people that they're responding to, it's because they know that they're going to get out a message that they want, mm-hmm. you know? And so sometimes you could almost like read certain outlets and realize, you know, what's expected, but how you actually navigate this stuff. It's funny. Like the only thing I tell people is I tell them like, you know, read widely and don't think that everything you read in the mainstream media is bad. And don't think that everything you read, like in alternative media, is good. You know, it's a mixed bag. You know, and you know, a friend of mine was giving a talk. He runs a journalism program at a big university, and we were talking about this. And I was saying, like, my advice is that when you read something, you want to know if you can trust it or not. Look at the outlet, because some outlets are more trustworthy than others. And then look at the reporter, because every outlet has good reporters and every outlet has terrible reporters. You can't just look at the New York Times and say, aha, well, they've got everything right there. There's reporters there. I know. I mean, there's a reporter there, Apoorva Mandavili, who's been covering COVID, and she's made so many mistakes that have been documented, some by myself, just like tweeting stuff out, but also like extensively by a physician named Vinay Prasad, who's at UCSF. You know, just repetitively over and over problematic false statements about COVID, but mostly about the vaccines. And they were always in one direction. Like, you know, it was always like, you know, the vaccines are better than they actually are, or, you know, there's more people sick than they actually are.
Right.
You know, it's just like on and on and on. It's always in one direction. That was a point he made when he was criticized. It was like, every time a Apoorva writes something, it's always wrong in one direction, you know? So,
using that as a kind of a launching point, there's a few that, so one thing in this recent article, and this just came out, but we're talking about ghostwriting, because I don't think that people know that's real. I think people think some of these things are conspiracy. And so they're not. And it's important that people understand that. Do you mind giving us just a little bit about ghostwriting, what that is, how that shows up in journals, and why this obviously can be a problem?
So ghostwriting has been documented in a lot of different fields, but the one where it's most common is in medicine. And there's, the funniest example I saw was, this was back when the SSRIs, so the antidepressants were being pushed really heavily back like in the early 2000s before we began to realize that there's a lot more problems with them than when we were being told. But there was a series that came out in a court case where there were these studies that were being ghostwritten by. What happened is the pharmaceutical companies will hire a PR firm to then draft up the study or draft up, you know, an essay or draft up whatever. And then they'll give it to a physician, an academic physician usually, because, you know, they have the name of the university behind it, to sort of put their name on. And then that benefits both sides. You know, the pharmaceutical industry gets promotion, you know, through promotion, but that doesn't look like promotion. It looks like it's a study because it's got a professor's name on it. And the professor benefits because, you know, the currency of academia is publishing, like publisher parents, you know, is a thing. The funniest example of this was there was a woman who was at Yale Medical School. And she had been given this, I can't remember, a study or an essay or something like that to promote these, I think it was paroxetine, which is, I can't remember what we call it in the States. The active ingredient is paroxetine. Is that Paxil, I think? I think it's Paxil. And it said on the top of the study, it said, it had her name and everything. And then it said at the top, to be removed before submission, cover page to be removed before submission. And so what I wrote about it was like, think about this. Think about you're smart enough that you get a good score on the MCATs and good grades that you get in a medical school, right? Then on top of that, you're so smart out of all the kids that got into medical school and completed it, that you actually get to become a professor, right, of medicine. And not only that, but you're a professor at one of the top medical schools in the United States, but you're too stupid to know that you got to hide the fact that someone wrote something for you. They prompt you with a cover page.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
And this stuff is rampant. We did a report on it for the United States Senate Finance Committee. Depending upon, some journals have up to 30% of their studies that are published in them have been ghostwritten by the pharmaceutical industry. There's been very famous examples of ghostwriting. Monsanto ghost wrote studies to help promote their they have a pesticide called glyphosate,
right.
And they were trying to make sure that people didn't think it was dangerous. It's Paul, come up in the plastics industry.
Isn't it weird how, you know, it's funny, you know, for some reason, and I think it's part of the kind of the propaganda or the story narrative behind it. You know, we have no problem saying, oh, we know tobacco does this, right? They almost call it the tobacco handbook, right? This, you know, create confusion. So we're easy to throw tobacco under the bus and go, well, that's crazy. We know they lied about lung cancer. But then for some reason, like the cognitive dissonance to think that another drug that's, you know, covered by an insurance plan, that one, that's untouchable. That's made in perfect harmony and no. Right. And I think that is what's so concerning, because now it's changing. Right. People are waking up, realizing they can't trust it. I mean, you can look at just the uptake on the, I say this halfway thinking I'm joking, but I believe we're on the 9th booster jab of COVID. It's unbelievable for me to say that with the 10th approved in the fall. And it's certainly the uptake numbers I'm seeing are very, very low, which I celebrate for the humanity, but I don't celebrate it.
You should know too that once you leave on those vaccine jabs, once you leave the United States and I believe like Canada and you come to Europe, and other countries, like the skepticism to those vaccines is much higher. Like we don't have, like I'm calling you from Spain. My wife is a physician at the leading research hospital in the country. You know, those vaccines were not approved for kids.
Over there.
I mean, this is very much like the fact that we have, you know, the CDC and the FDA saying that, you know, 2-year-olds should be vaccinated for COVID. Like that's a very American thing, you know,
like your wife would look at that and say, that's crazy. Even though she's over, you know,
not just my wife. Like when I was in England a couple of years ago for a journalism award, I had my editor at the BMJ ask me like, what's going on? Like in the United States with all this vaccine for kids, you know, the COVID vaccine for kids. And I was like, I'm telling you, like, it's very weird. There are vaccine fanatics in the United States. Mm. You know, there's a fanaticism about vaccines, which I see as something that's very obviously being promoted, you know, by the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, to get back to your issue about tobacco, you know, there's a couple of myths about tobacco. Number one is that tobacco did all this research and blah, blah, blah. No, that's not how they did it. What tobacco did is tobacco funded academics to pollute the academic research literature. That's how it worked. Starting in the 1950s. The program that was put together was that they would work with academics at research centers across the United States to put out a message that, you know, tobacco was not dangerous. So they harnessed the academic research centers back in the 1950s. And this stuff continues on, you know, today through pharma and other products. The second myth is that, you know, when we find out that a product is dangerous, like tobacco, that it's the researchers that figured out. That's also false. The way we find out and the way we found out about tobacco was not from the doctors, not from the researchers, although some of it was out of UCSF, you know, with when they got some documents there. It's usually the lawyers. It's usually the trial attorneys who are suing a company, who they get access to internal discovery documents, and they find out what the company knew and when they knew it and who they were paying off to say they didn't know it. That's how it works.
So, I'm thinking, of course, you know, Avandi is one of those. I think that happened with Celebrex and Vioxx, if I remember right. Similar, the discovery showed that these things.
So Vioxx, the reason why when I was in the Senate and we worked on that bill that the companies would have to, you know, to post when they, and turn into the government when they paid off doctors, that was over Vioxx. Because after Vioxx, we found out how dangerous it was. We just started asking ourselves questions from the committee in the Senate. You know, how did this thing get on the market? And what we looked at, we found out that a lot of the people on the FDA panel that approved Vioxx were taking money from the drug industry. And we're like, okay, we can't keep going after every single drug scandal that pops up because there's going to be another one. And then after we did this, what came along? Opioids, like one of the biggest ones in our lifetimes, right? We have to create systemic fixes. And so we have to require that doctors, you know, that companies disclose when they're paying doctors. Because what we found out is that, like, you cannot have corruption in medicine without collaborating with corrupt doctors. Doctors do. They do the studies, right? They sit on the panels to approve the products. They go and give the talks at conferences to other doctors, right? Yeah. They go and give, you know, talks at the lunches for doctors. And so they are critical to every bit of corruption. Now, and then with opioids, what did we find out, right? The guy who had been head of the medical school at Duke University. I'm blanking on his name right now. I wrote about this about a year and a half ago. It came out through the court documents. He was working hand in glove with the Purdue Pharma
Sacklers
to help, to push out opioids that then addicted and killed a lot of Americans. This guy had helped elevate Duke University Medical School to become the number three medical school in the United States. When this came out, none of the physicians said anything. There were no op-eds in the NEJM or op-eds in JAMA about how terrible what this guy is. Everyone just ran in the opposite direction.
Do you know, I don't have his name on top of my tongue. You might remember this, but this is just within the last year or so. There was the gentleman, you made me think of it, with Duke. I think he was a Duke researcher for 28, 29 years, and he raised some concerns about something as simple as Tylenol and some of the concerns that can happen at certain times when it's given. And then he was, after 28 plus years, he was removed from his job at Duke. And he said, I can't tell you this for sure. He just kind of read between the lines, but he said, one of the guys that sits on the board at Duke is, on the board at Johnson & Johnson, who makes Tylenol or whatever it was. And it's like, I think we're all smart enough to go, well, we can all see he's never had a problem in his whole time. And they said they're just going to discontinue that department that he's been part of for 28 years, which we all know that is not true. You have a couple of points, because this is interesting. And I don't know if this is the right correlation to make, but they just have that big freedom, or that yesterday in the United States at Supreme Court, they had a hearing about freedom of speech stuff that was going on. If the Missouri versus. And one of the things in there they're trying to say is government, pressuring companies to basically be their proxy, do their dirty work. It made me think of it when you said this with tobacco, influence academia, because they know, of course, they'd be subject if, Joe Camel comes out and says smoking is good for you. That would be weird. But if Dr. Scott says so, then that's going to be a little bit more palatable. So, the government says, well, we can't come out and limit free speech. That's going to look weird and it's certainly unconstitutional. But if we can get these businesses by coercion or proxy to do that, and it's really the same game. Do you have any thoughts on freedom of speech or freedom? Because I heard you on Jay's show, Jay Bhattacharya, the other day. That's what triggered me to reach out to you. And he, of course, is part of that lawsuit. Of course, you're familiar with that. Yeah. What's your take on that?
So I went to I can tell you this. Like when a lot of this censorship started happening, because the censorship happened. There's now did it really happen? No, it happened. People were censored. I know people were censored. It happened over and over again. When it first happened, I thought that this was simply, another example of PR firms working with corporations to shut down discussion and, manipulate public discussion. I did not suspect. And when I heard people making, allegations that the government was behind it, I was like, okay, well, I like to see a little bit of evidence.
So you were skeptical, then, even with all your background at that point and working with the government, you said, that's a stretch.
Yeah. I just didn't believe. I knew immediately, this is unconstitutional. And I think actually it may have been a conversation I had with RFK Jr. or some of his people where they made these claims early on that the government was behind this stuff. And I just didn't believe it. And then when I saw Matt Taibbi started coming out with the Twitter files, I was pissed because I was trying to get into Twitter too. And I was trying to work my angles to get in. And I eventually got there. And I got my own documents. But, to me, it was very eye-opening when Matt came out with these initial documents showing very clearly that, the government was leaning on these social media companies to, to basically censor people. They want to call it moderation, but that in itself is part of the Orwellian speak. And I can give an example of what happened to me specifically. In 2021, I wrote a piece for the BMJ. It was an investigation about problems with Pfizer's clinical trial. We had a whistleblower come to us. She had a bunch of internal documents, internal recordings about what was happening at the clinical trial for Pfizer's COVID jab.
With Brooke? Was it Brooke? We've had Brooke on. With Brooke, are you talking about Brooke?
Yeah, Brooke Jackson.
For sure, correct. Yeah.
Yeah, Brooke Jackson, the woman who came forward. And so, I got all these documents. I spent weeks going through them. And then I finally, called Brooke. Was checking her out. Does she make sense? Yeah. And we have the piece come out and the piece just took off. It is now, so there's a way you can judge impact of something that appears in science. And it's not, so there's a thing called citation factor where how many times is a study cited afterwards? Altmetric uses a different algorithm. It uses like citations plus tweets plus how many times it appeared in the media and everything. So it uses combined score to sort of give you an impact of something published in Science. That investigation I published in the BMJ is number three in the history of Altmetric. As far as having impact. Now, what was funny about that is I was interviewed by Italian television. I was interviewed by Korean television. No one in the major press in America picked up on this investigation.
Wow.
They just acted like it didn't happen. And then about 3 weeks after the story appeared, and it's still kicking along a lot, along comes this fact check. This one of these fact checkers says, fact check wrong, lacks context. And my editor contacts me about this. She's like, Paul, people are trying to share this on Facebook. And, you know, it now has this fact check thing on it. So I read their fact check, and the first thing it said is like, did the BMJ blog? And I was like, this wasn't a blog. Like, this thing is filled with errors. Like, I don't have time for this crap. You know, I'm working on things, you know, I'm like done with this story. It's been like 3 to 4 weeks. I've moved on. It's like, I'm glad that I wrote it. It was fun, you know, and like, I can't deal with these stupid fact checkers, you know, and I don't care. People can't share it on Facebook. And that really clued me into like what was happening with the censorship. Because it came out later through the Missouri v. Biden lawsuit that one of the attorney generals released an internal document that was an email between Facebook and the Biden White House. And in that email, Facebook agreed that they would limit, or I can't remember what the term they use, censor, whatever it was, information, even if it was true. I mean, remember they said true information on vaccines. And now in this email, this deal was done 6 months before my investigation appeared. So I was like, okay, now it makes total sense. Like why this fact checker came from, you know, I mean, like what the hell is going on? Because my editors wrote a letter to, you know, Zuckerberg saying your fact check is ridiculous. It makes no sense at all. It's false. You know, there were stories that appeared about it. And the fact checker was like, no, we're doing the right thing. But it was all a deal that was cut 6 months prior between the White House and Facebook, that they would limit, you know, vaccine information that went against the Biden administration's, you know, policies on vaccines, which is crazy. Now, what was also interesting in the Twitter files I found out was that, you know, so here the pandemic starts in early 2020, right? The vaccines are about to be approved by the end of 2020, right? So they were really online pretty fast. Right around that
skeptically too fast, in my opinion, but yes, carry on.
Right. Yeah. One might argue like it's pretty odd.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the funniest approval process was what happened in England when like, they were like the first one to approve. And I was like, what happened? Did Boris Johnson just call the health agency and say, get this thing out there? You know, like, who knows? I think that's probably what happened, you know?
Yeah.
So what I found out was I had this one piece of information that showed when they started putting in a program in place to moderate what they called vaccine misinformation and disinformation. And then what I found out was about a few months afterwards in this internal report that, you know, was circulated amongst, you know, people at Twitter, they began working with Johnson & Johnson to promote one of their vaccines in March of 2021. Wow. So how can Twitter be moderating vaccine misinformation, right? Misinformation on a product when they are simultaneously helping a company to promote that very kind of product, right? I mean, it's crazy, you know? It's totally crazy, you know?
Yeah, the mental gymnastics that you'd have to use to try to think that is some sort of altruistic, pure, hearted motivation, I think is going to be much more difficult than to just say, yeah, I think we all know what's really going on. Can you speak to... Go ahead, Paul. Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing. I actually think that this censorship that went on, I think it's why we're still talking about what happened during the... I know it's why we're talking about what happened in the pandemic, because part of what happened is we weren't allowed to talk about certain things. We weren't allowed to receive certain types of information that we're only getting to now. And so it's like, it makes total sense that in many ways we're still confused, because I mean, we weren't getting good information in real time. And so we're looking back now and like, okay, wait, what happened?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I just tweeted today. I just tweeted out today, there was a story that came out in March of 2020, right? So the second month of the pandemic. And it was an article in this Medical Express, some medical online news site. And it said, no evidence that masks stop viruses. You know, and I mean, it was like, there is no evidence that masks stop viruses. But for some reason, we went through this whole process for like, starting in like March of 2020, where like we suddenly denied all the science that we'd known about, about masks. And suddenly everyone said, like, put on a mask, it stops viruses. No, I just put on my mask. I did that. You know, I just wore my mask. And then what happened to me over time, I was kind of like, I kept running into physicians and epidemiologists telling me there's no real evidence that masks really stop viruses. Like, they were invented to stop surgeons from infecting wounds of people they were operating on from that bacteria, but like not for viruses. It's never worked for viruses. We've always known that.
Yeah.
And so we've got this weird process, I call it, there's another example of this I can talk about, where things that we knew before the pandemic, we knew things, and we unlearned these things, and now we're learning them again. And there's another example of this, I think it's perfect, that has to do with gargling that, like, you know, I just tripped across about a month ago. So what happened is, so I'll tell you what happened with gargling. This is like, you know, I don't think this is like very, this is very controversial. There was a study that came out, I want to say it was like late last year, December, something like that. And it said, hey, gargling can help stop COVID. You know, so if you're gargling with water, it can stop you from potentially getting COVID. And there's some ideas mechanistically what happens is that bacteria and viruses get, you know, stuck on the back of the throat. Gargling helps to loosen that kind of stuff up and gets it out of your, you know, away from your respiratory system. But regardless of what the mechanism is, there's this study came out and showed, it can, and it's not much, right? It's maybe, I think maybe like it lowers your possibility of getting, you know, sick 10, 12% or something like that, you know, of getting the actual virus. And you know, that you won't get quite as sick, or maybe like it, if you continue to gargle while you're sick, it might limit the number of days that you're sick, you know, like not a lot, maybe like instead of being seven days, it's 5 days, right? But it has an effect.
Okay.
And what happened is, so I was just kind of, and then people were tweeting out, they're saying like, but the fact checkers told us that that didn't work. So I went back and looked and I found a fact check that said, no evidence that gargling stops COVID, right? So I was just like, so these fact checkers told us information that was totally wrong. Then I was like, wait, what did we know before 2020? So then I go back and look, right? There's an article in the New York Times in 2015 that says, hey, here's this new study. It was actually a randomized controlled trial study out there. And it limits and lowers your possibility of getting sick from viruses by a minor amount. Like, and so gargling works. So, and there were other studies out there. You never want to rely on one study, right? You want to have a, you know, bunch of studies. So there's other studies showing like, hey, gargling works. So we went through this process where we knew that gargling can help stop or limit you from getting sick from viruses. Then the pandemic came along, we unlearned that, and now we're learning it again. It's very minor.
Well, but it does expose, I think, sometimes this the fallibility of our mind sometimes, how easily we you know, what is that? You made me like think about it when you said, you know, what is it? 90% of people think they're in the 10% of intelligence or whatever the statement is, right? We all think we're smarter than we are. And these moments in history, now it is very serious moment in history, because there's some very nefarious things that did happen that we need to learn from. So I haven't heard that said before, but I think it's a very valid point, because there are people that say, hey, let's just move on. Let's let bygones be bygones. And, you know, you hear these stories that, you know, the science was just, we were speed of science. And I don't necessarily agree with those statements, but the reason we do need to have these conversations still, I think you're opening up kind of a different train of thought there, which is because we really didn't know, we weren't able to talk about this the way we normally do for so long. And so it's actually, it's kind of like what the jabs have actually caused this thing to probably keep going, because we keep pressuring it and we keep trying to jab people out of COVID, and you're not going to do that. And it almost is making the problem worse long-term. At least some of the science is saying that. Let me ask you this though, Paul, because this is interesting to me. So I haven't had a lot of people on to talk about this from overseas. So in your day-to-day, you told us you live in Spain right now, or you're over there. Is it just a whole different, because correct me if I'm wrong, I always hear that there's only two countries, United States and New Zealand, that allow direct-to-consumer advertising. I've traveled the globe a little bit and some other countries. It always does shock me when I'm in different countries And you just don't see the advertisements. You don't see the billboards. You don't see hospital advertisements. It's just kind of like not a lot going on. What is the vibe in just the country, at least that you're in? Is it different? Do you not really think about it as much? I had a friend that was just in Mexico and they're like, they don't care in Mexico. It's fine. Like they moved on. What's your take about, at least, you know, you sound like you get around the globe a little bit. What's your take on this from that perspective?
You mean on the pandemic, you mean specifically?
Well, or just, I would honestly ask, Paul, just even like healthcare, like, are you less medicalized over there, or do people want their drugs like they do in the US, or what's your take?
Well, so like I live in a country with socialized medicine, right? So my wife is a physician, and the hospital she works at is the top hospital in the country, but it's owned by the government. So my wife is a government employee. And the way it works is everyone is covered by the system. And then if you want to, you can, you know, pay more insurance. You can go to a private hospital.
Okay.
The way the private hospitals work is things are nicer there. The food is better. You know, the rooms are nicer. My wife is a neonatologist. Mm-hmm. So she's got like kids that are very sick, and sometimes there'll be parents there. And, you know, the parents might have to crash on the floor. There's like maybe the McDonald's house or whatever. Whereas at the private hospital, like, you know, they'll probably wheel a bed in, you know, they'll charge you more, but they'll wheel a bed in. So you sleep right there with the kid. Right. But the thing it works that happens though, is that if you really get sick, you leave the private hospital and you go to the good hospitals, which are the government hospitals. That's where all the best people are at. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's where our system is. And, you know, the other problem with the socialized system is that people can, because they can go to the doctor all the time, they can just kind of show up, you know, like, you know, the emergency room or something like that. So that's a problem. But I think in general, in a system that's not profit driven, you don't have, doctors are not incentivized necessarily to do all these treatments and to give all these tests and to give all this, you know, kind of crazy stuff. I'll give you one example. You know, this vaccine, because my wife, you know, works with neonates.
Oh, right.
Yeah. This one pharma company came to her. She told me this story, and they wanted her like to give some sort of, you know, comment about this vaccine,
like endorsement or something.
Yeah, endorsement. And that'd be great because it'd be this, you know, a doctor from the leading hospital, you know. Blah, blah, blah. And she looked through all the information they gave her, and she was like, okay, well, it looks like this, you know, works, and it looks like it's beneficial, but it's so expensive. And what it's treating is so like not that common, and we can fix it when it happens, that economically it doesn't really make any sense, you know, to have this vaccine. Like, it wasn't like whether it worked or not. It's like, you know, this isn't that big of a deal. We know how to fix it. It doesn't even happen that often anyway. And so she's like, well, I can't really endorse this, knowing that what they had told her at the time was, well, we're sending 6 doctors to the annual Congress. So she's like, they're not paying for
she's
my
not
airfare.
She's going to get invited back to that little luncheon. Yeah.
Yeah. She's not, she's going to have to, like, if she's going to go to the, you know, annual pediatrics conference, she's going to have to pay herself. It's not going to be the company. And so, you know, you just don't have necessarily the financial incentives that are lined up to, like, you know, promote products, you know, to the patients and to the doctors. It's kind of a different funding system. I mean, it still happens, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, still happens. Doctors still get, you know, sent on trips and stuff like that by the companies, but it's at a slower speed. Like, I just feel like everything in America is just up at a hyper speed. You know, there's like way more money. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's way more.
It really is. If you're watching TV over there, you don't see drug ads. They're not in everything. Is it?
No.
Do you feel like because we just had a study that came out, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, Paul, but there was a study that came out at the end of last year that said the life expectancy for men has gone down again in the U.S. I believe 73.2 years. There's a delta of 6 years between men and women now in the United States. I'm pretty sure that Spain does better than us. Just curious, you know, culturally, is there more of an awareness of health over there? Because you have, of course, lived in the United States, you live over abroad now. Like, what's your take on that? Yeah. Are you more health conscious, or is there just less crap available?
I think part of it is, I mean, look, you know, a lot of the reason for, you know, the drop in lifespan, like when we look at these things, right? There's a lot of these diseases that are like lifestyle choices what's driving a lot of that. I mean, a big portion of that in the United States is the opioid epidemic, which was started by the pharmaceutical industry.
Suicide.
We didn't have that in Spain, you know? We had a heroin epidemic back in the 80s, like everyone did, but we didn't have the opioid epidemic like what happened in the United States, you know? And we don't have the obesity levels, which are caused by the food, you know? It's like, it's kind of obvious. The obesity is worse. I think all the obesity problems are worse in, Black Americans, Blacks in America. And you go back and look at Blacks, like, you know, out at the beach or whatever, you know, back in the 70s, like they look the way they looked.
Right.
Genetics change, you know, it's lifestyle, you know, and food, you know? And so the food in America is causing a lot of the problems, you know? And so there's so many, I just feel like there's so many differences, you know, I mean, in how socially, like the things we eat, you know, kind of how we do medicine, I live in Madrid. I don't have a car. Mm-hmm. I pretty much walk everywhere. I'll take a taxi. My wife walks to work. I work from home, you know? I mean, so the lifestyles are very different. So, and I think when you have that many parameters are different, it's hard to make judgments on what's causing the difference. Yeah. But I think the problem in America, I mean, to me, my wife was back there when we were just back there. She's like, oh my God, if I stay here much longer, I'm going to start gaining weight. And the food, like the plate size and the kind of stuff that you get is just enormous. And then on top of that, it's like, you know, I mean, our fix to the problem of food is like, you know, of corporate food is like, you know, corporate drugs, mm-hmm, you know,
mm-hmm.
and like that's driving a lot of the food is driving so many problems in America.
So as we kind of wind it down here for, I don't know if you have some hope for us, but if you don't mind, so where do you see this going? Do you think was this a watershed moment that enough people woke up that there is concern in the industry that they want this to change? Like you said, we're relearning some things that we did know, and then COVID, everybody got hypnotized, or a bunch of people got hypnotized for a while, and they're coming back around again. Do you have hope for the industry? Do you still feel, Paul, your job is to really, you know, kind of bring these things to light so people become aware? Are you hopeful? Are you discouraged? Have you written off America? You know, what do you, there's some things you see that can get better?
I mean, a couple things I can tell you going back like 10 years ago, 15 years ago when I was working on the Hill, a couple conversations. One was me and a reporter at the New York Times, out for drinks one night and just talking about all the corruption in medicine from doctors. This is a reporter who was writing a lot of those stories about that was going on. And, you know, you got to understand, like, it was very easy for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and other outlets to write these stories because doctors were doing things that like reporters would not be allowed to do. Like you couldn't take money from someone and then, you know, go out and write about them. And it happens in third world countries. Mm. You know, I mean, I was in Nigeria teaching journalism and they were making fun of like, well, do you get the, you know, I think they call it the brown bag, you know, when you go and interview someone and he's like, what are you talking about? Wow. Like, journalism in those countries, we don't do it like that, you know, in the United States. And so it's easy for reporters to be like, why are doctors allowed to do this? Like take all this money and then, you know, go out and write prescriptions. That's crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember we were out and he was just saying like, you know, I feel like things are so corrupt right now that like, you know, I think it's like, it's going to change, you know, that like, I don't think people really realized how terrible it was. And so then what happens after that? Like the opioid crisis, you know, which was done the same way. So like not much really changed, right? You know, and then the other thing is talking to a buddy of mine that I worked with on the Hill, who's still there running investigations for one of the committees in the Senate. And I remember him complaining one time about like these people, we were like talking about like, these people are so corrupt. Like, how do they do this stuff? And I just told him, I said, you know, if it wasn't for corruption, you and I wouldn't have jobs. Mm. You know, think about that. You know, I mean, so it's like there's plenty of corruption. I think there's going to be plenty of opportunities for people to write about the stuff that I write about after I'm gone. Because I think that a lot of this problems, they can't really be fixed so much. They get fixed and then they come back again. And it's because of the fact that, you know, in all of this stuff, in medicine, in the scientific process, it's all people and people have these endemic problems. And when I was thinking about this a lot, I was at the Harvard Safra Center looking into corruption. And the thing I realized, you know, all these positions like, you know, well, here's how corruption works. And I was thinking, like, the Catholics figured it out. It's the seven deadly sins, you know? And mostly what I deal with is greed and ego. Because most of what I'm dealing with are scientists and doctors who are greedy and want the money and then think they're so smart that, like, everyone else is stupid and doesn't know things as well as they do. And I just don't see that. I don't see that ending because it's just, it's people.
Human condition. Yeah. You know, Paul, it's been really fascinating having you on here and giving us a different perspective and helping us think about this broader or just sometimes we can get, and I'm guilty of this. I can get so stuck on an issue because it's so frustrating to me and you see the implications of it. You see people that get hurt through whether it's, you know, a drug of Andy or I'm sure we'll be reading about Ozempic here in the next months to years as the truth comes out about that. And they'll get more discovery emails through lawyers and we'll realize they lied about a bunch of stuff and they hurt a bunch of people and they'll sue them and they'll be now. Meanwhile, the company will be on to their next drug, unfortunately. And so it does require, you know, some vigilance and some advocacy from people like you and then on our own. I don't want people to, you know, you can't hand off your agency to somebody else. You can't hand off your brain to somebody else. You do, but people like you can help us ask better questions. And so you're, you know, for those of you that are listening, I don't want to put words in Paul's mouth, but he was not saying, hey, take everything he says as the gospel truth. You know, look into it yourself. Do some asking, do some thinking. But it's good to follow people like Paul's work at the Disinformation Chronicle. He's a great example. A friend of mine said one time, you know, truth and time go hand in hand. So you've been in this for a long time at a very high level. You understand, you know, fairly deeply the issues and the implications to that. And so it helps, your position helps us. We can trust you. Like you were talking about the reporter who, you know, if they're wrong a lot the same way, I don't know. You might want to find a different source there. Your track record is strong. That's why I wanted to talk to you and get your perspective. Right. And so I know they can follow you at the Disinformation Chronicle. Sign up for his Substack. He's very active. It sounds like you're on Twitter as well. Just to see what you're thinking about, see what you're investigating and help us discern this. And so I really appreciate your time, my friend. And we'll have to have you back on probably because you're right. This category is not going away. So as long as there's humans, there's probably going to be corruption. And as long as there's that, we have something to talk about. If you want to have the final word there, buddy, go ahead.
The best I can tell you is my advice is to read widely, read skeptically, and always look at sources of information that, like what I try to do is I try to base everything on documents, you know, and that's, you can't always do that, but like look for sources that do that, that like look at good source material and that don't rely on, I called up the expert and here's what the expert said. Because oftentimes you don't know if the expert is being paid or if the expert has a particular, you know, ideological position that's not totally understood. So read widely and read wisely.
It's good advice. I appreciate you, Paul. Have an awesome day and we'll talk soon, my friend.
Thanks so much, guys. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Designed to Heal. Always remember that the greatest doctor lives inside of you and God gave you what you need to be healthy and well. Connect with Dr. Ben at drbenrawl.com or achievewellness.clinic. And please share this podcast with someone who needs to hear it and follow us on Instagram at Designed to Heal Podcast.